Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the forced resignation of Attorney General Jeff Sessions and his replacement with a Trump loyalist, and assess the growing possibility that the Mueller probe will be shut down or have its scope and independence curtailed, if not neutered. Joshua Geltzer, the founding executive director of the Institute for the Constitutional Advocacy and Protection, who served as a senior director for counterterrorism on the National Security Council staff and as counsel to the Assistant Attorney General for National Security at the Justice Department, joins us. We'll discuss the significance of the next in line, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, being skipped over, with Trump installing Sessions' Chief of Staff Matthew Whitaker, who has been critical of the Mueller investigation. Adding to concerns that we may be on the cusp of a constitutional crisis, at today's combative press conference, Trump remarked that he had the power to fire Mueller if he wanted to. And following an election in which Republicans won key races by a razor-thin margin, we will also discuss Joshua Geltzer's article at Just Security, "Don't Be Fooled, There Was Election Interference in 2018. Then, following an election in which Fox News made no pretense at being a journalistic outlet, with Sean Hannity appearing on stage at a rally with Trump and Fox & Friends host Ainsley Earhart telling the press to report the news the way Trump wants it, we will speak with Yochai Benkler, professor of law and co-director of the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. He joins us to discuss his new book, Network Propaganda, Manipulation, Disinformation, and Radicalization in American Politics, and Trump's enabler in propaganda, Rupert Murdoch, and the phony war with the press on display today in the White House, with Trump casting the press as the enemy of the people to distract from the obvious fact that the truth is the enemy of Donald Trump. Then finally, with the Democrats getting a much-needed win to take over the House while the Republicans extended their control over the Senate, we'll examine how we are moving into a new normal in which the Democrats routinely will get a majority of the vote but still end up unable to gain meaningful political power. Sanford Levinson, who holds the Centennial Chair in Law at the University of Texas Law School and is the co-author of Fault Lines in the Constitution, The Framers, Their Fights, and the Flaws That Affect Us Today, joins us to discuss the daunting prospect facing the Democrats in the long term as American democracy becomes less competitive and more unrepresentative. And joining us now, Joshua Geltzer, who's the founding executive director of the Institute for the Constitutional Advocacy and Protection, as well as a visiting professor of law at Georgetown University's Law Center. He served as senior director for counterterrorism on the National Security Council staff, having served previously as deputy legal advisor to the National Security Council and as counsel to the Assistant Attorney General for National Security at the U.S. Department of Justice. And he has an article at Just Security, "Don't Be Fooled, There Was Election Interference in 2018. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joshua Geltzer.
Thanks so much for the invitation.
Well, thank you, Joshua. And what do you make of the fact that Rosenstein was skipped over, somebody that's made it very, very clear that he has reservations, shall we say, about the Mueller investigation? Attorney General Sessions' Chief of Staff Whitaker has now been made the acting Attorney General. Obviously, it'll take a while to find somebody, a permanent Attorney General. But nevertheless, as acting Attorney General, Whitaker may be able to do what he suggested should be done, which is, if not shut down Mueller, at least curtail his activities. What do you expect?
It's concerning, to be sure. There are many of us, and I frankly think many Americans across the country, who, whatever their political views, who think that Mueller and his team are doing important work to get to the bottom of what happened in the lead-up to the 2016 election and what role Trump or others in the Trump team may have played in that. That information has begun to come out through criminal charges that have been brought by Mueller's team, but they're quite clearly not done, at least in their own minds, and it seems that they're entitled to finish their work and ultimately present a report, at least to Congress. So to see what appear to be changes to the Justice Department designed to at least hamper that work, if not outright end it, I think that should be a concern to all Americans, regardless of political views, who are interested in trying to understand how we protect our elections and ensure that they're free from foreign influence and from any collusion with foreign powers.
Well, Whitaker wrote in an op-ed in CNN that Mueller has come up to a red line in the Russia 2016 election meddling investigation that he is dangerously close to crossing. If he were to continue to investigate the Trump family's financial relationships without a broadened scope in his appointment, then this would raise serious concerns that the special counsel's investigation was a mere witch hunt. Well, it turns out that's an inaccurate statement because Mueller has a pretty broad mandate. But that is a pretty straightforward signal, is it not? And are we at a point now where Trump, and particularly when you caught what he said today at the very combative press conference, essentially what it looks like to me, Joshua, is that Trump is laying down a red line. You know, I think Mueller's more or less indicated he doesn't want to indict a sitting president, but isn't the marker that Trump's putting out there, don't go after my family?
It certainly seems that he's choosing somebody whose views are, as you say, quite public and quite clear about his skepticism of, maybe more like hostility to, Mueller's work. And the position espoused that somehow Mueller was overstepping his authority is one that's been rejected by Rod Rosenstein as the person overseeing that work. It's been rejected by the judges in front of whom Mueller's team has brought criminal charges. And not surprisingly, some of the defendants defending against those charges have raised that as a defense, have said this office has gone past where it was supposed to go. And judges, including one who initially seemed quite hostile to Mueller and his team, nonetheless said, that's not how we read the mandate that's been given to this office. So it seems no coincidence that the new person who will be acting attorney general has a hostility to that work. Now, it's not automatic, it seems, from the Justice Department regulations that control of this, or I should say oversight of this investigation, passes away from the Deputy Attorney General, acting AG for these purposes, Rod Rosenstein. Conceivably, it could stay there even with a new acting Attorney General. But that doesn't seem to be the impetus for Trump making the moves that we see him making at the Justice Department.
Well, that's an absurd argument, though. It's like saying a cop investigates a whorehouse for prostitution and there's somebody dead on the floor. And the madam says, well, you can't investigate that for murder because you came in here to investigate prostitution.
That's about what the judges have told the defendants Mueller has been charging. As they've said, look, what you've charged us for is money laundering. What you've charged us for is something other than direct interference with the 2016 presidential campaign. What the judges have said is no. Mueller started with the basic concerns and facts that led to his appointment in the first place. He then investigated. That investigation led him to the forms of criminal activity that ultimately were the basis for criminal charges against the likes of Paul Manafort. And when Manafort and others have protested, judges have said something very similar to what you just said, which is Mueller found his way quite reasonably, quite responsibly to criminal activity, and it's within his mandate, not outside his mandate, to go ahead and charge that activity.
And again, I'm speaking with Joshua Geltzer, who's the founding executive director of the Institute for Constitutional Advocacy and Protection. He's also was the counsel to the Assistant Attorney General for National Security at the Justice Department and has an article, Just Security, Don't Be Fooled, There Was Election Interference in 2018. So it looks as though, to my mind, the writing's on the wall. And frankly, the president himself from day one with Sessions, he's been incredibly insulting towards this man who I don't have a lot of sympathy with because I don't agree with anything that he's done. But nevertheless, he's been treated very shabbily. And the way that Trump talks is like a mob boss. He basically says this: the attorney general should have been my lawyer, protected me, not upheld the laws of the United States. So he doesn't. He seems to have a completely different idea about the law. And if you look at his record, he's been one step ahead of the sheriff most of his adult life, it would seem. He seems to be at war with the law. And so this is pretty brazen to my mind. Is there any chance that he can get away with this? This will be a major play on his part to shut down the Mueller thing. But looking at him today, he's combative. He's contemptuous towards the press, and I suspect he's going to fire Mueller. And what do you think would happen if that were the case, or do you think it will happen?
Well, I start where you start, which is to see what's a real ethos gap, you might call it, between this president and how law enforcement has normally been treated by presidents. Even though the Attorney General and the rest of the Justice Department obviously do ultimately work for the president, there has been quite careful drawing of lines to try to preserve law enforcement as something free from political taint, even if ultimately those people report to the president. And that's a sensibility very useful and seemingly at odds with every inclination of this president. What he'll do if he indulges those inclinations further is a little bit unclear. Whether he'll ask the acting attorney general or some subsequent confirmed full attorney general, in fact, to fire the special counsel is unclear. The fate of the report that's presumably being prepared by that office won't necessarily be resolved simply by the firing of the special counsel. Even open investigations will not automatically become closed in the way the DOJ and FBI think about these things, simply if that office or its lead were to be fired. They might, at least by default, resort to a U.S. Attorney's office. And whether the U.S. Attorney's office actually picks up on them is, of course, unclear if the person mm-hmm. who'd been running them was fired. My point is really that there are ways to meddle with this, either by limiting the resources or ultimately by firing key people. But it's not immediately obvious what that means for the work that this important office has put into motion.
And Widdock has already indicated that he might starve Mueller of funds. But just in the last minute, let's talk a little bit about your article at Just Security. Don't be fooled. There was election interference in 2018. You say that it actually has been even worse than 2016. It's just gone under the radar.
Unfortunately, I think that's right. It's looked different in 2018 from how it looked in 2016. Instead of, for example, Kremlin-backed actors massing followings behind particular accounts, instead there have been new websites and accounts with smaller followings that have cropped up and injected a lot of disinformation and inauthentic commentary into our political discourse. What's more, it's ongoing now. It's not so much that it waits for a particular candidate in a particular election cycle. Instead, there's been documentation that political issues, especially the divisive ones, like whether to release the Nunes memo or immigration issues or even Justice Kavanaugh's confirmation hearing, the dialogue about those on social media is being fueled day to day by Russian-linked actors. And that, of course, leads into how people think about how they vote on a day like yesterday. So we have, unfortunately, not solved the problem of election interference that we all saw more clearly after Election Day 2016. And I think it's important a day after Election Day 2018 to recognize that that challenge is still here.
Well, Joshua Geltzer, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Joshua Geltzer, who's the founding executive director of the Institute for Constitutional Advocacy and Protection. He is also was the counsel to the Assistant Attorney General for National Security at the U.S. Department of Justice. And he has an article at Just Security, Don't Be Fooled, There Was Election Interference in 2018. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about how the Trump presidency would have been over a long time ago, but for the propagandist in chief, Rupert Murdoch.
And now, a word from the president.
Damn, it feels good to be a gangster. Getting voted into the White House. Everything looking good to the people of the world. But the Murphy family is my boss. The voters of the world keep supporting me. And I promise to take you very far. Other mothers better not upset me. Or I'll send a million troops to die at war. To all you Republicans that helped me to win, I sincerely like to thank you.
Red rum, political bedlam. Don't let the hype into your eyes and eardrum. Murdoch on Fox, not 18 with Barackas. And he hate Barack cause he marched with the marches.
I pledge allegiance to the fair and balanced truth. Not the biased truth, not the liar's truth, but the highest truth. I will not be deceived, nor will I believe in the propaganda. I will not.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Yohai Benkler, who is the Berkman Professor of Entrepreneurial Legal Studies at Harvard Law School and faculty co-director of the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. And he is the co-author of the new book, Network Propaganda, Manipulation, Disinformation, and Radicalization in American Politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Yohai Benkler.
Glad to be with you.
Well, thank you for joining us. And today, at a very combative press conference, President Trump was very angry and insulting towards one particular member of the media from CNN. But in general, his tone was quite hostile. He was asked a question about what he should do about social media in terms of policing content. And he cited the First Amendment and said he was a huge believer in the First Amendment and thought that that probably meant he wouldn't do anything, or at least approach it cautiously. But my sense about these new platforms and their enormous importance and influence, like Facebook, for example, isn't the problem the platforms themselves?
So I think our research actually pushes back to some extent, not that there's nothing wrong with the platforms, is what we find, but that at least when you're looking at American politics, television is much more important, talk radio is not less important, and a lot of the most destructive disinformation is not the result of platform algorithms, but the result of a sustained campaign on one side, and on the other, long-term competitive dynamics in the right-wing media ecosystem that practically force anybody operating in that market to just ramp it up to the sharpest, most extreme versions of self-reinforcing stories. So it's just a lot less about, at least if you look at the United States, it's a lot less about the digital, the platforms, and a lot more about the political culture and the media ecosystem on the right.
And there is, as you point out in your new book, a kind of asymmetry here, is there not? That on the right, even though liberals and conservatives are arguably both in separate bubbles, and there is no consensus in this country anymore about what is true and what is real. If you, for example, go back to the days of Walter Cronkite there on the evening news, Uncle Walter seemed to be believed by most Americans. Now, those days are over. But there is a tendency, and I've fallen into that tendency myself, to equate Fox and MSNBC by saying, well, conservatives get their information from Fox and liberals from MSNBC. But at least on MSNBC, they do practice journalism. And I think it's important that you have pointed that out.
So our observations really come out of the data. We analyzed millions, I mean literally 4 million political stories from 2015 to 2018. And we analyzed the data on multiple dimensions. We looked at what online news sites link to, so how media producers link to each other, which the platforms have nothing to do with. We looked at Twitter. We looked at Facebook. We used text itself and the similarity of text. Again and again, what comes back when we use different platforms, when we use different measures, and when we use different techniques, what always comes back is that you have a stark and insular right-wing media ecosystem anchored in Fox and in Breitbart, where the entire dynamic is to reinforce the set of partisan beliefs, police anyone, whether it's a politician or a media outlet, that steps out of line, and compete between the major sites having the least extreme versions, and then sites competing and differentiating themselves on just how extreme the rhetoric they can throw is. There is no such thing on the left. Essentially, if you go all the way from the, let's call it, center-right Wall Street Journal or Forbes, all the way to the left, It's not that you don't see partisan outlets. You absolutely see partisan outlets. But they're all part of a single media ecosystem. And we see when we look at audiences based on Twitter, based on Facebook, the audience also spreads its attention much more broadly. People seem to be looking at a more diverse range of outlets, some in the center, some in the center left, some in the left. And this structure, both of audience behavior and of outlet behavior, forces everyone to be more measured, to be more anchored in reality. There's real competition between the outlets to criticize each other if they get it wrong. There's real competition to come out first with the story, but also to come out first with the debunking. And that dynamic in the much more diverse and ideologically broader media ecosystem on the left means that it operates much more anchored in reality and less stoking of extremism. There is some extremism in very specific outlets. It's not that you don't see disinformation and very sharpened views. But overall, when you look at the population, these sites play a much more peripheral role, whereas on the right, they really are the center of the media ecosystem.
And again, I'm speaking with Yochai Benkler, who is the Berkman Professor of Entrepreneurial Legal Studies at Harvard Law School and Faculty Co-Director of the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. He's the co-author of the new book, Network Propaganda, Manipulation, Disinformation, and Radicalization in American Politics. And your new book refutes, to some extent, the conventional wisdom about how much Russian manipulation in the 2016 elections was effective. It's not to say it didn't happen, but its effects have been exaggerated. And you also suggest that the micro-targeting by Cambridge Analytica, its effect has also been exaggerated. But that's not to say that in effect, Fox News and Trump himself are examples of the success of what Vladislav Surkov brought to the table in Russia. The new term, of course, for people like Vladislav Surkov, a former theater director, is a political technologist. And he taught Putin how to manipulate reality and turn politics into theater. And we have a reality TV star in the Oval Office, and he and Fox News certainly do that. I mean, you saw Hannity on stage with him just the other night. The loop is complete, shall we say, with Bill Shine, the protege of Roger Ailes, who started Fox News, now as the White House communications director.
Absolutely. Every piece of that, in my view, is right. In other words, absolutely, when we looked for Russians, we found them. They're there. They're trying. And for people who are concerned with the legitimacy of the election, there's no question that for a foreign power like this to intervene in American politics in the way that they did is illegal. And for someone to collaborate with them, actually in terms of conspiring to perform illegal acts like hacking, is also illegal. Not that the U.S. did not intervene and doesn't intervene in other countries clandestinely, but let's put that aside. The point is not whether they were trying or whether what they did was illegal, but did it have an impact? And when we actually dig in deeply into the concrete allegations of how the Russians influenced the election, and we study all of the email, all of the stories about the emails, and the specific crazy conspiracy theories that came out of one or the other, consistently we see the Russians essentially jumping on the bandwagon of things that were already pushed on the right, leaning into themes that were already there, and in many senses being relatively peripheral. So if you spend a few hundred thousand dollars doing targeted advertising to suppress the vote, and you know that the campaign, that the Trump campaign itself spent millions doing the same thing, it's very hard to suddenly say that was exactly the incremental additional piece. And the same is true with regard to Cambridge Analytica, which seemed to be more hype from the company itself. But the core point you're making, which is that the strategy that emerges in the middle of the first decade of the 20th century in Russia, but really ramps up with Putin around after 2012 when he comes back, of continuously confusing everyone and making the entire project of understanding what's going on in the world being more a piece of entertainment, and essentially everyone doubts everything and nothing is true. That's a remarkably effective tool for authoritarians, because if everything is true or everything is untrue, then the authoritarian leader can essentially get away with everything. And this is absolutely central to the strategy we see now with Trump, rolling out one outrage after another, things that are completely impossible, like we'll give a tax break while Congress is not in session. One flows after the other. The caravan is showing up. Some of them are specifically tailored to incite. Others are just confusing. That state of affairs, where you have a whole population that simply doesn't know where to look in order to find what's true and not, makes it much easier for an authoritarian figure like Trump to get away with anything, because everything is possible, nothing is true, you do whatever you want, and no one can hold you to account because no one knows what's going on. Enormously dangerous.
So then that leads me to the question about who is enabling this, and that has to be Rupert Murdoch. And you have to ask yourself, what is going on here? Apparently Murdoch is very much a mentor of Trump, talks to him regularly, if not every day, on the phone. And then he hangs up the phone and says, "What a bloody idiot," you know. And then he's also the literally the matchmaker who put Ivanka and Jared Kushner together. So obviously there's a connection there. But why is Murdoch doing this, do you think? Is it power? What explains that cynicism?
So I'd rather not speculate, because this isn't something I know from my research, and I really avoid doing that. I don't know what drives Murdoch. It's obviously a fantastic business model, and it's been an enormous success for Fox News. It may well be primarily a political ploy, but I think it's important not to focus, at least for me, not to focus on the individual agency, this terrible evil genius or that terrible evil character, but rather to look at the structure of the problem, which is to say, before Murdoch, there was already Limbaugh. Alongside Fox, there's already Clear Channel buying up hundreds of radio stations, buying Premier Radio, the producer of all of the major talk radio shows, and programming coast to coast, 24 hours a day, bile and hatred from Limbaugh, from Glenn Beck, from Sean Hannity as well. So you're getting, these are not Murdoch, but they're doing the same thing. Breitbart, this is again Mercer-funded, Bannon-led, also not Murdoch. What's important in this regard to understand is that the structure of the network, the way in which these actors have learned how to make a lot of money from using the fact that the Republican Party drew in as part of its base both strong white identity voters and strong religious voters, each of which for its own purposes is disconnected from, let's call it, mainstream professional judgments of how you get things right and wrong, and then uses this market segmentation to make big business out of telling people what they want to hear and giving them their daily shot of bile, anger, outrage, the sense of shared identity from hating someone else. It's that big business of selling outrage, selling hatred, selling affirmation and membership to this audience, that's much more important to my mind than any single individual who is a large player in this market.
Well, in terms of the audiences for the liberal and conservative media, it's pretty clear that liberals want facts and conservatives want their biases reinforced, and that's certainly what Limbaugh and company do. And to my mind, you know, there's not a great deal of difference between the profession of journalism and being an intelligence officer, in the sense that you're supposed to be skeptical, you're supposed to be inquiring, you're not supposed to be gullible, you're not supposed to believe propaganda and the first thing that people in power tell you. That is the antithesis. And that, frankly, I think is a more traditional or useful definition of what liberal means, to be skeptical as opposed to be gullible. But how do you operate in an environment where to Donald Trump, the truth is irrelevant, but to journalism, the truth is everything? So you've got the president saying the press is the enemy of the people, when it's very much more likely that the truth is the enemy of Donald Trump.
Well, I think that the core diagnosis of the press is the enemy of the people only if the truth is the enemy of Donald Trump gets it just right. When you ask what do you do, I think as long as it appears to be the case, and this might change over time, but as long as it appears to be the case that there's a good 15 to 25% of the population who do vote Republican, who do lean Republican, who do sometimes watch Fox News, but are not 100% in that echo chamber, they do also watch a lot of local news. They do also watch a lot of network news. They watch some CNN. It's less reading newspapers, actually, and the relatively older audiences, so not so much online. That audience becomes really important to educate and to help remember this ideal of a moment of Walter Cronkite, as you describe it, even though when we look at it in hindsight, we understand that that was a deeply problematic dynamic, excluding views not only on the right but also on the left, having a very patriarchal view often, excluding views of minorities. It's not as though we actually believe that in the myth of the Walter Cronkite era anymore for anyone. It's complicated. But continuing to insist on the importance, not falling for really now everything is just a bias confirmation, so we have to move for that. Being very explicit to audiences about what's going on and not falling for traps. One of the classic, there's tremendous media activism, if you want to think of it in this way, going on, both from Trump and from right-wing media, that makes it very hard for mainstream media to just leave things alone. So in the campaign, it was the Clinton emails and the Clinton Foundation. This last midterm, it was the caravan. It was the sudden decision that he can get rid of birthright citizenship. Each of these, essentially, you throw a flame into the fire, and it's very hard for traditional journalists to contain themselves and not cover, because it's so outrageous. It draws audiences. Mm-hmm. And so it will require a lot of self-discipline from editors and journalists about how to curate, what to cover, how not to cover, how little to cover something that's unimportant, even if the president is talking about it a lot. That's not easy, and that's a completely different way of thinking about journalism when you're in the presence of such highly asymmetric and cynical propagandism than it was when everybody was more or less in the same universe of what it meant to have facts, not to have facts, to try to investigate them, not to investigate them. So I think that's the big challenge of journalism today. It's far from solved, but I think as soon as journalists and editors recognize that this is the great challenge in the teeth of propaganda, they can at least start to be more thoughtful, more conscious, and more constructive.
Well, Yehoi Bankler, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Likewise. I'm very grateful for this conversation. And again, I've been speaking with Yohai Benkler, who is the Berkman Professor of Entrepreneurial Legal Studies at Harvard Law School and faculty co-director of the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. He's the co-author of the new book, Network Propaganda, Manipulation, Disinformation, and Radicalization in American Politics. We can take a brief station break. We're back looking into the election results in both the House and Senate in the context of the structural disadvantages Democrats have going into the future.
Television rules the nation. Television rules the nation.
We want the power for the people. That's all we ask in our country, dear. The sick and the hungry unable. Protect them and those who may live in fear.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Sanford Levinson, who holds the Centennial Chair in Law at the University of Texas Law School and is currently a visiting law professor at Harvard Law School, a regular contributor to the popular blog Balkanization. He has written 6 books, including Our Undemocratic Constitution, Where the Constitution Goes Wrong and How We the People Can Correct It, and with Cynthia Levinson, Fault Lines in the Constitution, The Framers, Their Fights and the Flaws That Affect Us Today. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sanford Levinson.
I'm delighted to be here.
Well, thank you. And as Democrats celebrate taking the House with a pretty narrow cushion of extra votes, Republicans are also celebrating their increased win in the Senate with much more pro-Trump loyalists seated in the next Senate. But in the long run, are we not moving towards a world where Democrats can routinely get a majority of the vote and still not be able to gain any meaningful electoral power?
Yes, that's the long and the short of it, that we have a system constructed in 1787 to make governance difficult, though not under the assumptions of 1787 impossible. Because you have to understand the original Constitution as written by people who had an inordinate degree of confidence in their own civic virtue and who were trying rather desperately to stave off the development of a party system. The fact is they weren't successful. And depending on which historian you read, the party system arises as early as around 1795 or 1796, and certainly no later than the election of 1800. And what we are experiencing now, and this is what, say, Tom Mann and Norm Ornstein have written about in their book, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, is that we have basically parliamentary-style political parties that have been set down on a constitutional system that, to put it mildly, is not really constructed for that. And so the difficulty that was built into the 1787 Constitution has ended up generating almost endless gridlock in the 21st century.
Well, the other factor, I think, is that, and you have pointed this out, Sanford Levinson, that even though Democrats are, I think, breathing a sigh of relief that they won something, there's been a sense of gloom for some time. Obviously, there's a great deal of disappointment amongst progressives who were invested in Beto O'Rourke, and that was always an uphill climb. So the Senate results obviously depress Democrats, but the House results give them some heart. But in general, how far are we from reaching a point since we already have about the lowest turnout of any democracy or advanced democracy, how close are we to a point where a majority of Americans will, because of the structural imbalance that favors the Republicans, how long before they just sort of give up and say that, you know, my vote doesn't count? And you might be able to argue, at least I suspect it's the case, that the Republicans are quite happy with that, yep, to reinforce despair.
Right. I think that's the most important single question one can ask, because what you're really getting at is the legitimacy of our political system, rather than simply the technical way that it works, or even, you know, the constitutional basis of how it works. And the perception that at some level elections are less important than they're said to be with regard to actual governance. I mean, I think what Democrats can be genuinely elated about is that the control of the House means that zero of the Republican Party platform will pass in the next 2 years. The whole debate about repealing and replacing Obamacare is over. The debate about further repeal of Dodd-Frank is over. It might very well be that the debate about the wall is over, unless the wall is traded for a multi-billion dollar infrastructure program or the like. But that's not positive legislation. It's simply preventing the worst. And so if you try to induce people to participate in elections because, you know, some candidate, call her Hillary Clinton, presents 21-point programs and says, you know, if you elect me, I'll work hard for this 21-point program. The fact is, there was never the slightest possibility that any of Clinton's elaborate programs would get through a Congress controlled even one house by Republicans, let alone both houses. And so there's a kind of con game going on where you try to tell people, look, if you want good things to happen, vote for Smith or Jones or Garcia or whoever. But then you really have to recognize that good things will happen only if, as in astrology, all the planets are aligned. And that happens kind of once a generation. It happened in 1964 to 1966, when the Democrats really did control government. And you look back at the accomplishments of those 2 years, and they're miraculous. But that was 50 years ago, and it's very, very unlikely that it will happen again. There's also the particular problem, the particular illegitimacy of the Senate. I don't know exactly how many votes Dianne Feinstein got yesterday in being returned to the Senate, but I'm guessing, given that California has 39 million people or so, I'm guessing that Senator Feinstein got about 10 million votes or so. And the successful candidate in North Dakota, I think, got about 75,000 votes. This is crazy that Senator Cramer should have the same voting power as Senator Feinstein, or, to be blunt, that, you know, Bernie Sanders or Pat Leahy, both of whom I admire and certainly fit my own politics far more than the two senators from Texas, one of whom I loathe, that is Ted Cruz, and the other one of whom I simply wish weren't our senator, that is John Cornyn. But except for raw politics, it's indefensible that Vermont, with a total population of about 650,000 people, has the same voting power as Texas, with 27 million people. James Madison, in fact, in 1787, thought
that this aspect of the Senate was indefensible. In Federalist Number 62, he describes it as a lesser evil. And so you have to ask yourself, well, what was the greater evil? The greater evil was that we simply wouldn't have a Constitution if you didn't submit to the extortionate demands of the small states like Delaware. And so Madison reluctantly came to the conclusion that you had to pay off these small states in the same way that you had to pay off the slave states with, say, the three-fifths rule that enhanced the representation of slave states in the House of Representatives and in the Electoral College. You know, it may be that this is right in terms of just raw political calculation, but quite frankly, there's no more defense for the Senate than there is for the three-fifths compromise. And, you know, today it would be absolutely bizarre if anybody said, well, the founders made their peace with slavery, so should we, to argue, well, the founders made their peace with equalizing Delaware and Virginia, though I think Virginia had something like 17 times the population of Delaware, and so should we. No, we shouldn't. And I think, you know, behind your question is, at what point will Californians or Texans or Floridians or New Yorkers or the people who live in the states with the highest population, already you get more than 50% of the population in nine states with a grand total of 18 senators. In by 2040, I think it's supposed to be the case that 70% of the entire population will live in 15 states with a grand total of 30 senators. You know, we fought a revolution in, or what I call a secession from the British Empire, in 1776 because British rule was perceived as illegitimate. So what I think underlies your question is, at what point will people start saying the Constitution drafted in 1787 really has generated a political order that is illegitimate in the 21st century?
And again, I'm speaking with Sanford Levinson, who holds the Centennial Chair in Law at the University of Texas Law School and is currently a visiting law professor at Harvard Law School, a regular contributor to the popular blog Balkanization. So you mentioned Feinstein. She got 3.5 million votes to Kevin DeLeon's 2.9 million, and DeLeon barely ran a campaign at all, and we know that she's only going to serve probably a year or two and then retire and hand it over to the mayor of Los Angeles, who's got presidential ambitions. So the whole thing is rather disgraceful, I think, particularly given that Feinstein herself, I think you can hold largely responsible for Brett Kavanaugh getting on the court, because she sat on that letter, she didn't act on it.
Right.
And then eventually the letter was leaked to other members on the Judiciary Committee, and they acted on it. But by the time they did, it was too late. And it gave the impression that the Democrats were unseemly and desperate. And that had a terrible effect on them, and it may well have cost them a lot of Senate seats. It's hard to know. So,
right.
You know, we have within this endangered creature called the Democratic Party, we also have some problems within the party itself. It needs to reinvent itself, you know.
Right. But between Feinstein and DeLeon, roughly 6 million Californians indicated a preference for the Democratic Party, whereas in North Dakota, fewer people than live in West Hollywood, I suspect,
right,
were able to elect a senator.
Right. Well, in the Kavanaugh case, just to finish up on that,
yep,
the senators who voted against Brett Kavanaugh's nomination represented 38 million more constituents than the Republican senators who confirmed mm-hmm. him. So there again, you have this incredible imbalance. There are some solutions. There's the national popular vote solution to get rid of the fact that, you know, our last two Republican presidents got fewer votes than their opponents, and they put four people on the court
right.
just recently.
Yeah, Right. Let me tell you, though, my hesitation. I don't know whether I want to call it opposition, but it's certainly my hesitation about the National Popular Vote Initiative. What they're responding to, as you're suggesting, is 2016, where the person who comes in second actually wins the electoral vote. And that seems outrageous. But let me suggest that there's also a deep problem with, let us say, the 1968 and 1992 elections, where Richard Nixon and Bill Clinton, respectively, got to the White House with about 43% of the popular vote. I'm a big fan of what Maine has now adopted, in fact, which is the so-called alternative transferable vote, which would require that whoever gets to the White House get a demonstrable majority vote. And we have a system that not only means that on occasion the person who comes in second will win the Electoral College, but just as frequently, or in fact more frequently, the person who comes in first does not get a majority of the vote, and you can make a good claim that that person would not have received a majority of the vote if you had the alternative transferable vote or a runoff system. And I think that if we call ourselves a democracy, there is something, and given also the remarkable and questionable power that a president enjoys, that there's something disturbing about the fact that you can get to the Oval Office with 43% of the vote, even if you came in first.
Well, I know the IRV, as it's called, or as it's called in other countries, proportional voting system, makes an awful lot of sense, and it also gives third parties a chance,
right,
and erodes the kind of frozen edifice of the duopoly that we have here in the country. And as it stands now, when you, under our current system with the duopoly, third parties tend to be spoilers. And one of the Senate races the Democrats lost in Arizona, the Green Party person got enough votes to stymie Kyrsten Sinema and allow the Republican to win. So
that's exactly right. And I'm furious. And I don't know whether I'm more furious at the Green Party candidate or the people knowing how close it was who decided to vote for the Green Party candidate. Ironically enough, in the 2016 election, I think some of the people who voted for Jill Stein, or for that matter, Gary Johnson, believed the New York Times and thought that Hillary's victory was basically a sure thing, so that there was no real price that would be paid if you wanted to cast a protest vote. I don't think that's a rational view with regard to Arizona, and you know, that really is a huge price. I would say, incidentally, that proportional representation works only in multi-member institutions like, for example, the California legislature or the House of Representatives. It doesn't work where there's only a single winner, as with, you know, a governor or a senator or a president. So at that point, I think we should talk of the so-called alternative transferable vote, where you get to rank order your choices. And at that point, people in Arizona could happily have voted for the Green candidate in order to make a point, but then said, well, my second choice is the Democratic candidate. I find it literally inconceivable that any of the Green voters would have said that their second choice was McSally. And then I would have no objection at all to people voting Green or, you know, any other third-party candidate. I share your view that one of the real problems with the current American political system is the two-party duopoly, and I would love to see it broken. And there are ways of doing it, but one of the things that really depresses me is that there's very, very little discussion of alternative ways of doing things at what might be called, you know, the leadership level, whether you're talking about nationally recognized politicians or the group of nationally recognized pundits who are able to generate conversations. What happened in Maine is really, really significant, and it ought to be receiving far, far more publicity than it is. Just as I would say, incidentally, that the single most encouraging result yesterday, other than the Democrats getting the House back, was the decision in Florida. At the very same moment, they were electing two really dreadful people to be governor and senator. Over 60% of Floridians voted to restore voting rights to convicted felons who served their time. And I think that's extremely important and will and could very easily change the reality of politics in Florida for 2020.
Sure, but particularly given how close those votes were in both the Senate. I'm afraid we've run out of time, and just in closing, you know, the thing that drives me nuts, Sanford Levinson, is that our press, I think, plays a part in propping up this dysfunctional electoral system we have with ridiculous impediments like registration and different state rules and people lining up around the block, you know, for hours and hours. It's absolutely unconscionable. And if you watched last night, either on CNN or MSNBC or even on Fox, it's all about process. It's all about slicing and dicing all kinds of bizarre little factoids about this little constituency here. And it just drives me crazy because nobody ever talks about our elections in the broader context that the system itself is what's screwed up.
Right. You know, just one last comment. I think you're right in your specific comment, but I think that one of the deficiencies of the way we discuss politics is that we don't generally recognize the crucial importance of process, whether the process is the ridiculous Electoral College or the consequences of having exclusively single-member districts or not having runoffs or not having things like the alternative transferable vote, that or those things are regarded by most people as dull and boring as against substantive issues like health care or guns or affirmative action or whatever. But the devil really can be in the details. And the people who constructed the Constitution in 1787 were very, very well aware of the importance of procedures. And from my perspective, they imposed a whole bunch of really bad ones. And we ought really to be discussing those procedures much more than we are. But I'm very grateful to you for giving me this opportunity to chat with you today, because I think what you're doing is just extraordinarily important.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Sanford Levinson.
Good, thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Sanford Levinson, who holds the Centennial Chair in Law at the University of Texas Law School. He's currently a visiting law professor at Harvard Law School, a regular contributor to the popular blog Balkanization. He's written six books, including Our Undemocratic Constitution, Where the Constitution Goes Wrong and How We the People Can Correct It, and Fault Lines in the Constitution, The Framers, Their Fights, and the Flaws That Affect Us Today. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.